The city of Des Moines has some 1,500 full-time positions, but not one of them is dedicated to bicycling concerns. That may change soon. Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll hear about Des Moines' push for a new bike coordinator, UNI's search for a new president, why Iowa is well-positioned to forge ahead with clean energy, despite doomsday scenarios about the climate after the November election. And we ring in the holidays with a look at arts events around the state. Buckle up for your News Buzz and make that pledge of support now. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The University of Northern Iowa is in the process of hiring a new president after former UNI president William Rood resigned to take another position with Marietta College in Ohio. Our Dean Borg has been covering the hiring search for Iowa Public Radio. He joins me now. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
So we have three finalists, I understand, being considered for the next president of the University of Northern Iowa. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, Ben, in contrast to the University of Iowa's president, which raised some eyebrows because of his business and non-academic administrative background, these are all academicians, and they're all in their 50s. The first one who was interviewed is 58 years old, and he's a native Iowan, incidentally, a native of Holstein, Iowa. Holstein is a community out in west central Iowa. His name is Mark Nook. As I said, he's 58 years old. He's currently chancellor at Montana State University. He was appointed there just a couple of years ago, July 1st of 2014. And before that, he spent considerable time in various roles in the University of Wisconsin system, concluding there as a senior vice president. And as I said, he moved on then to Montana State University. And that is a university that sort of mirrors the mission of UNI in that it began and has evolved as a teacher education university. Of course, UNI has moved far beyond that, but as you know, UNI used to be named years ago as Iowa State Teachers College. The enrollment at Montana State is 4,300, and it's been declining. Now, Nook has a background in science. He's a physics and mathematics graduate, 1980, from Southwest Minnesota State University, has a master's in astrophysics from Iowa State University, and then astronomy in 1990 from the University of Wisconsin. Now, he was interviewed earlier this week. He was the first one to be interviewed. The second one to be interviewed, 52-year-old Jim Wolpert, is currently the UNI interim president, and he has a background mostly in Tennessee, and his background is in English, and he's been UNI's provost and vice president for academic affairs for about a little more than a year now. He came to UNI in 2015 after 21 years at Florida Gulf Coast University. And the third one, interviewed yesterday, 59-year-old Neil Theobald. And I'm sorry, Theobald was the first one interviewed. Nook was interviewed yesterday, but it doesn't matter the order in which they were interviewed. But Neil Theobald was the first one interviewed. He is has a background that some may raise eyebrows about this. He most recently was president of Temple University and had 4 years as president there. And that's one of the Temple is one of the three state universities in Pennsylvania. But he resigned August 1st in a bit of controversy out there. He had removed the provost, and after the removing the provost, there was faculty unrest, and the Temple's Board of Trustees gave a vote of no confidence in him, mm-hmm. and he may have been facing firing. We don't know that. He didn't evolve to that. He resigned instead. So that is the background on Neil Theobald. He's 59 years old. He grew up in East Peoria, Illinois, He has a bachelor's in economics from Trinity College in Connecticut, and his doctorate is from the University of Washington in 1988.
Dean, you've covered many hirings of university presidents in the region's business for many years. Any sense here about which one might be a favorite, the Iowa native Mark Nook or the current interim president, the insider, so to speak?
I couldn't even begin to predict anything like that. That's up to the Board of Regents. And one thing we do know, Ben, from past hirings of university presidents, and I don't have any insight. I wish that I did, and perhaps it's something that I have been overlooking. But the two presidents who most recently hired Iowa State University's president is a background, not a background, he's really a plant pathologist, but he's a very good fundraiser, and that is something the Regents have been putting some emphasis on, Bruce Harreld at the University of Iowa, the same way. And so I don't know what weight they might put that on that at UNI, but UNI also is facing and has been facing some declining enrollment. They've sort of reversed that, but just as the experience that I talked about at the Montana State University, Mark Nook, the native of Holstein, Iowa, who's out there now, they have declining enrollment out there. In fact, they've had to cut the budget. That was the same thing that has been happening at UNI. They've sort of reversed that at UNI, but it might come into play with somebody who has experience.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes left, Dean. Any other main challenges aside from enrollment that the next UNI president will be addressing?
Well, I think enrollment is the big thing. Now, the thing about UNI, you recall, Ben, is that almost 90% of UNI's enrollment is from Iowa. And they have been counseled in the past about maybe looking outside the state to get some of the balance, first of all, from outside the state, but also the out-of-state tuition. And that's what Iowa State and Iowa have done in the past. Now, that has been sort of reversed, too, as you recall, in about the past 2 years in which the Regents were putting a premium on enrolling Iowa students, and that has put pressure in Iowa on the private colleges and the community colleges in Iowa because the Regents institutions are recruiting from the same pool they are now and recruiting very actively. Now, where does that put you and I? Back to your question, I can't really answer that. I'm just putting in perspective that UNI has this particular balance in their student body right now, and because of that, they have some financial concerns at UNI.
Mm-hmm. These three finalists are all white men. I wonder, any concerns you've heard about a lack of diversity?
I can only say this, Ben. There was a fourth finalist identified. We don't know who that is because the name was never identified to us. The procedure here was identifying the finalist only on the day before they interviewed, mm-hmm. and that fourth finalist withdrew. So we won't know who it is. I just suspect that it might have been a female candidate. In the interest of diversity, that might have been a female candidate who withdrew.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, Dean, we have to go in just a minute, but you mentioned at the outset, of course, this is the first president hired for a public university in our state since the controversial hiring of the University of Iowa's president, Bruce Harreld. Has that, to your knowledge at all, colored the process?
I can only say this, is that the faculty union, it's only UNI's faculty among the state universities in Iowa administered by the Board of Regents that who has or which has a unionized faculty. And that UNI faculty took an interest in what happened at the University of Iowa and worked with the faculty at the University of Iowa, which ended up with a national organization of this faculty union censoring the University of Iowa, as you might remember. But the faculty union at UNI is conducting its own survey, listening to what the candidates are saying in the forums and their interviews on the campus this week, and they're going to submit a report also on their findings and their perceptions of what they've heard to the Board of Regents.
Dean Borg, thank you very much for this update. Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg on the hiring of the new University of Northern Iowa president. Thanks, Dean.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The city of Des Moines has some 1,500 full-time positions, but not one of them is dedicated to bicycling concerns, but that may change soon. Mackenzie Elmer joins us now. She's been reporting on the push for a full-time bicycle coordinator. Hi, Mackenzie.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. You're the Des Moines City Reporter with the Des Moines Register. Why is the city considering hiring a bicycle coordinator?
It's something cycling advocates have been really pushing for over the last year or so. When I ask cycling advocates, they tell me they feel like plans for city road designs often favor motor vehicles. So they really just want someone who is working within the city who can be there early on in the planning and be an advocate for bike and pedestrian issues.
Mm-hmm. So what would this position do more than that? So work with, be a liaison between bicyclists and the rest of the city and in thinking of new ways to make a greater Des Moines area more bike-friendly?
That's my understanding. And if you look, kind of Iowa City has a bicycling coordinator who works actually both for the city and for the Metropolitan Planning Organization. And I guess they're more of a, they just need someone who is a go-to person for bicycling issues. Cycling advocates in Des Moines just feel like they don't have someone they can just go to who would know where all the different transportation committees or engineers, where they all stand on the plans going forward.
Mm-hmm. But this is not a sure thing. This is depending on if there is a budget for such a position, right?
Correct. And I'm still not sure, I haven't heard yet from the city how much this position would cost the city, but the city manager did assure when I asked him that he was planning on putting it in the first budget that they present and when they're kind of putting everything together, but it may not survive the budgetary process, which is a longer ordeal.
How much do you think this is a response to the cycling deaths that have happened this past year and the media attention they've gained?
It's interesting that this arises in a year where there have been more bicycling deaths than average. There's been about 11 in 2016 in all of Iowa. I think that I'm sure that plays some sort of a role, especially as getting bicycling advocates. They've really gotten their voices out there. They've been speaking a lot louder about these issues. I'm not sure specifically how it pertains to the coordinator position, but I'm sure that's all part of the gusto behind cycling causes.
Mm-hmm. I know you've looked into those cycling death statistics. 11 in 2016 caused bike deaths due to accidents, crashes with cars and so forth. Is there a common theme there? Is it the roads not marked properly, or is it the overall awareness or lack of awareness that we have about bikes as a part of, as users of our roadways?
Yeah, you know, I did want to just correct myself there. There are 11 total crashes, bicycle fatalities, excuse me, but 9 of those were with cars. The pattern that we've seen just in our look at 5 years worth of data since 2011, it seems a lot of cyclists are killed on county roads, hit from behind by cars. And that might be an awareness issue from drivers. There's a couple of cases of distracted driving. Recently, there was a case over in Plymouth County near Sioux City where a driver was distracted for about 8 to 10 seconds from his kid in the back seat and hit a cyclist who was biking across country. He's actually from Pennsylvania and paralyzed him from the waist down. So it's just another example of being aware on the road and keeping your eyes forward. I think that's really sometimes all that matters.
Mm-hmm.
In
generally,
some of these cases.
Yeah, and generally speaking, when a cyclist death or paralysis, as in that case, a serious injury occurs, the driver faces what kind of penalty if distraction is the cause?
Yeah, well, distracted driving is a secondary offense in Iowa, which means cops can only give a ticket if they see a different traffic offense, and then they can charge it as a secondary offense. So there's not very strong laws there with distracted driving. Also, Iowa, as we've reported, has weak reckless driving laws. It's hard to get that kind of a charge in these sorts of fatalities. So typically we see traffic fines in the $250 level or so. Mm. In the case of the one in Sioux City, we're still waiting on a sentencing, which should be coming up here in the next couple of weeks. But he was charged with, I think, following too close to a cyclist and then no proof of insurance, which are also just traffic offenses. Mm-hmm. So.
Mackenzie, we have less than a minute, but in July, Governor Terry Branstad said that addressing cyclists and traffic fatalities will be one of the major issues he'll discuss in January's State of the State address. So I guess there are hopes that the legislature may enact some better laws to protect bikers.
Yeah, we'll be interested to see what happens there. We'll be following that closely. I know the Iowa Bicycle Coalition has been, they had an online petition pushing for stronger laws on this issue for the next session, and we'll definitely be looking to them to see what kind of proposals we'll put forth in terms of traffic laws and bicycle safety.
Okay, bike on. Thanks, Mackenzie Elmer, Des Moines City reporter with the Des Moines Register. Take care.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Coming up in just a moment, as News Buzz continues, Jeff Biggers will stop in, writer and journalist. He'll tell us why Iowa is well-positioned to forge ahead with clean energy when we return. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Paris Climate Agreement, signed by almost 200 countries, aims to limit rising temperatures that have been linked to the extinctions of animals and plants, heat waves, floods, rising sea levels. Recently, President-elect Donald Trump said he was keeping an open mind on whether the U.S. will pull out of that landmark international accord to fight climate change. He now admits, these are his words, to some connectivity between human activity and global warming. Previously, he described climate change as a hoax. Jeff Biggers is with us, writer in residence in the Office of Sustainability at the University of Iowa, author, journalist, founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa. On Wednesday of this week, his opinion piece appeared in the New York Times under the headline, Cities and States Lead on Climate Change. Jeff Biggers, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So you start off your piece by writing, the wind turbines that rise out of the cornfields here reminded me on a recent drive of one post-election truth, even in the red state of Iowa. What is that post-election truth?
That clean energy, it can't be reversed. You know, Ben, within 3 years, 85% of our electricity coming from Mid-American is going to be coming from wind turbines and wind energy and clean energy. In the meantime, we have this incredible burgeoning solar industry that employs over 200,000 people nationwide that is really taking off. And so my feeling when I was driving home across western Iowa and across Iowa in general was to say we've gone through this clean energy revolution. It's led by the states. It's led by the cities. And it really doesn't matter what's going to be happening in Washington in many respects, because already the states and the cities are going to be in the lead working with private investors.
Is that just to make people who are very concerned about climate change feel better? This is actual fact. You are not as concerned as a lot of people who are concerned about this were post-election.
Right. I don't want to understate the enormity of what we're facing. Last week, the United Nations Environmental Program released a study that said, in fact, the Paris Accords that you referred to at the beginning were grossly insufficient to really meet the urgency of the times, that we, in fact, have to double up and redouble our efforts for climate action. You know, so I think with the changing of the administration and potential setbacks in our energy policy and our climate policy are very serious. But the truth is, the real battlegrounds over this is going to happen in the cities and it's going to happen in the states. Because as we speak today, 70% of our carbon footprint is coming out of our urban areas. And so this is something that we as mayors and as governors and as local citizens can take a huge role in affecting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us a little bit more about perhaps at the city level, the municipal level, what's been happening that encourages you?
Well, as we're speaking right now, mayors from around the world have converged on Mexico City for a historic summit. It was organized by the C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group. And Michael Bloomberg, of course, the financier who was the former mayor of New York City, has been very active in this group. Over 128 major cities and over 100 American cities have been working together to actually come up with a climate plan that we can do on a local level. And what they're meeting with and doing this week in Mexico City is to redouble those efforts in light of the November elections to really put the cities in the forefront. Specifically, what they're talking about is what happened last month in California, for example. Governor Jerry Brown said, hey, we're going to pass a law that says we have to reduce our carbon footprint, reduce our carbon emissions by 40% below 1990 levels. So this is a dramatic drop in our carbon emissions, meaning that now we have to create the framework to reach that goal. And so by cities and states setting these very ambitious benchmarks, we're going to be able then to lay out a plan that forces us to meet those in many different levels. And this is from our electricity to our transportation to our food systems to our waste systems, completely how we function as a city.
Mm-hmm. I've heard economists argue that even when you put the very serious consequences of climate change aside, green energy makes sense in terms of economics, that it is what a businessman, and we will soon have a businessman as president, businessman might choose purely on for in an economic argument.
Right. You know, the old battle we used to have between you have to make an environmental choice or an economic choice just doesn't make sense anymore. Now, because of the incredible decline of the prices of solar energy and the incredible success of wind energy, we've reached a certain parity now with our former systems that it's a win-win in every situation. If you look at a city, for example, like Adelaide, Australia, which is way down below, they decided to embrace what we're calling a regenerative city framework. The idea, instead of talking about doing less bad, let's actually be actively trying to make up the damage we've done and actually do something that's going to enhance our environment. They completely redesigned their city, and they went from being dependent on coal, like many states are, to having over 40% come from renewables. At the same time, they redesigned the neighborhoods by going through 100% solar energy eco-districts. They have the first solar bus in the world. They use 92% of their urban waste now as compost in farms that ring the city. They created an infrastructure for local food. By using this regenerative city framework, just within a few years, they cut their carbon emissions by 20% while they increased their economy by 28%. Hmm. And they had this enormous boom in green jobs in the green economy. And so it really has become this incredible model of you can truly move and develop, but in a very regenerative way that's not going to do damage.
Okay, so if, as you state and have evidence for, this is really in the hands of the states and the cities, what can citizens in these states, in our state, in our cities do to propel this forward?
We need to really push our city politicians to reach high and to be ambitious and to set the benchmarks high. Now is not the time to have a mayor or a city council who find excuses of why they can't do things. For example, in Des Moines, because of a great citizens movement, the mayor went to the Paris Climate Summit last year, and so did the mayor of Dubuque. And that was wonderful to see that they're actually making that commitment. And the mayor in Des Moines, for example, has recently announced his decision to join the City Energy Project, which means that he's going to be aiming to cut 50% of the energy use in Des Moines within 25 years and hopefully become a carbon neutral city by 2050. That's an incredibly ambitious framework to shoot for. So here in Iowa City, what can we do? On Tuesday, in fact, our Iowa City Council is going to vote on a climate action plan. And they have agreed to go with the Paris Accords and try to cut carbon emissions by 26% of 2005 levels. Well, already we've been told that falls far too short. But even worse, our Iowa City Council wants to wait and hire a consultant and actually not release a climate action plan for at least 2, if not 3 years. They want to take 18 months to actually draw up something and then another 6 months or whatnot to put it together. So we're talking about not even implementing a climate action plan for 2 or 3 years on our fiscal calendar. And so we need cities and citizens within our cities to tell our politicians this is not enough. You need to do what the mayors are doing in Mexico City. You need to implement a climate action plan now. I mean, think about it, Ben. Chicago passed a more ambitious plan than Iowa City wants to do in 2008. And in fact, in the last 8 years, they've been moving rapidly in terms of clean energy and a carbon plan, carbon reduction plan. Dubuque passed a plan in 2013. The little town of Fairfield nearby passed an amazing carbon reduction plan in 2009. So we need to catch up in Iowa City, and other cities in Iowa need to catch up as well to a lot of people who are really being in the forefront of climate action.
So what is your overall impression of the climate change debate here in the United States? Why it's so politicized in this country when in other parts of the world, climate change science is recognized by all stripes of politicians as a given. Scientists agree on this.
Right. You know, we had a study come out last year that said 60% of Iowans, including the rural districts, believe climate change, in fact, is a human-induced situation and that necessarily needs to be dealt with. So I think often the media stresses this conflict. The media embellishes the debate and the conflict between whether or not we accept climate change or not, when in fact the studies and most of the recent polls show that the majority of the people do believe in climate change. I think we still have a very vociferous and vocal minority who continue to deny the situation of what's really happening on the ground. I think even people who deny climate change are living daily with the realities of drought or flooding or changing of temperature. If you're a farmer in Iowa, they know better than any of us the impact our changing climate has had on their fields. And whether or not they believe in climate change or want to publicly talk about it, they want to talk about how can I best get the best yield on this piece of land when I'm having flooding and drought and these kind of extreme situations.
Rural parts of the country, the heartland of the U.S., went overwhelmingly for a candidate voted into president who called climate change a Chinese hoax.
Right.
That must mean what? That's not a priority, even if, they believe in climate change, human-induced climate change?
I think you're exactly right. I think you really hit the point there. You know, a Yale climate study came out just 2 months ago, and it found out that 70% of the people never talk about climate change ever. That if you sit around the dinner table when we're having breakfast, when we're hanging out with our friends, when we're reading the newspaper, 70% of the people never bring up the issue of climate change. And it's a tiny minority, only 3 out of 10 people, who actually are talking about this. And I think that's part of the problem right now. It's not climate denial. It's basically a certain climate cynicism and an avoidance of what we need to do.
That the train's already left the station? We can't do anything anyway?
Right.
In part?
I think in part, many, especially for the millennial generation, there's a sense of, well, are we doomed? Well, we're going to be doomed anyway, so party on. And I think a lot of other people are saying, no, we need to do something. And so I think that's part of the situation, those of us in the media but who are involved in the public realm, is we need to be talking about this more. We need to have forums. We need to have community gatherings. We need to be talking about this at our places of worship, whether you go to a synagogue or a church or a mosque. We need to be talking about it with our children. You know, Portland passed an amazing school district ordinance or bill, or whatever you call it, for the school district that says they have to teach climate justice within the school district. You know, they can't avoid it. And I think this is the kind of things we need to be mandating. We need to be talking about these issues. And this doesn't mean that we need to talk about the gloom and doom, but we need to be talking about solutions. And I think this is what excites me about this whole regenerative city movement, is whether we're in Iowa City, whether we're in the Iowa City School District, whether we're in the state of Iowa or in the country at large, in rural areas or urban areas, we can be talking about what we can do on a local level that really is going to have a major impact. And I think that's when people begin to pay attention, and that's when people really want to get involved, when they realize, wow, I can do something about this.
Okay, thank you, Jeff Biggers. Look for his opinion piece online. He wrote it this week in the New York Times under the headline, Cities and States Lead on Climate Change. Jeff Biggers, author, journalist, founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming in, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me now, Jacqueline Hallbloom, Iowa Public Radio classical music host, also host of IPR's monthly Iowa Arts Showcase, which airs tomorrow, Saturday, December 3rd at 11 o'clock and 5 p.m., if I'm remembering correctly. Jacqueline, hi.
Hello, you've got it right.
Okay, it's on Iowa Public Radio Classical, our classical stream. And Jacqueline, you are here to tell us how to ring in the holidays and the New Year's. This is a combined arts showcase, December and January, with Iowa Arts. So tell us what's up.
Well, the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater is doing their January set, and this is a double bill this time out. They're doing Cavalleria Rusticana and I Pagliacci. And what's really cool about this, in addition to the great music, is they're going to have a bunch of Iowa singers who've made quite wonderful names for themselves. Three mezzo-sopranos, Catherine Goldner, Janera Kellerman, and Teresa Buchholz, will be appearing, as well as tenor Chris Carr. And then, this is a good one, Ben.
All right.
They're bringing in former Cleveland Brown football player who has turned into a tenor.
No.
Yes.
Fake news is a big thing these days. This is not fake news, is it?
No. This person apparently had an injury. Tao Pupua had an injury. Have you heard of him? And
no.
He was a singer before, but he turned away from football and became now a professional opera singer. And I guess not only is he quite good, but he's very impressive on the stage. You don't want to argue with this guy.
Oh.
Because he'll take you out. No, I don't know that. But anyway, it's going to be a marvelous performances. We talked to the artistic director, who is also one of the founder, and also the director, about these performances, and that'll be on January 13th and 15th in Cedar Rapids at the Paramount Theater.
Mm-hmm. You know, Italian opera is not one of my strong suits, so tell me, I could have thought I ordered these off an Italian menu, the two names of these things. What are the tales of intrigue behind these two operas?
Well, it's you've heard about opera, and you know it's like love, hate,
yes.
Revenge,
yes.
Killing. It's all in here.
Okay, more of the same.
Plus some incredible music. And
okay.
It's really neat. And plus, with the two operas, you get sort of an extra dessert, because you get a full second opera. And the first one is a one act. The second one is a one or two act, but they're both short operas, and they're often coupled together, and it'll be very, very fine.
All right. Opera fans in the central part of the state also can look forward to the Des Moines Metro Opera. What's going on there?
They are doing an innovative new opera. This was written in 2008 by David T. Little, and it is called Soldier Songs. And what David T. Little did was he interviewed a bunch of his relatives who were veterans and took these interviews and crafted it into an opera. And it's actually a one-man opera, and it features baritone Michael Mays, who's a longtime fan of people who go to Des Moines Metro Opera concerts, because he has been, I think, in three main stage productions with major roles. He's just got a fantastic voice. And he loves these gritty new roles where you really have to get down and get into it. And this is going to be held at the Freedom Center at Camp Dodge, which is an unusual place to have an opera, but it's part of the Des Moines Metro Opera's Second Stages series, where they take new operas, innovative operas, and take them to new locations. And this is going to be a fantastic production. That's going to be on January 27th through the 29th. It's going to have multimedia, some really interesting things with the orchestra. It's cutting edge, and if you are an opera fan, old or new, I think you will really enjoy this performance.
Let's go from Des Moines, the Des Moines Metro Opera, to Cedar Rapids, happenings at the Bruce Moore Mansion.
Well, Bruce Moore Mansion is such a cool place,
yes.
And if you've never been there, you should try to go, particularly over the holidays, because mm-hmm. they pull out all the stops, literally, to decorate the place. They also have someone performing on the 1929 Skinner organ. It's going to be a marvelous time to go see Bruce Moore. Also, they just have conserved the sleeping porch at Bruce Moore. And this porch is pretty special because it was designed and built by Grant Wood. And this is open now for people to see. So it's a great time to go to Bruce Moore and not only see the mansion, but also see this porch that has just now been open to the public.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I see on the docket Brassy Canadians due in Iowa for a couple of performances.
This is a real treat for Iowans. The Canadian Brass is going to be at the Gallagher Blue Dorn tomorrow afternoon, and they're also going to be appearing at Civic Music's Cheslow Auditorium spot in Des Moines as part of their series on December 9th, Friday. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to hear some incredible brass performances by these world-class brass musicians. And they are a lot of fun. They like to make jokes, but they also love to play beautiful music. And it's It's well worth the time to go to one of these performances.
Jacqueline Hallblum, I wanted to have you finish up by commenting a little bit on the Nutcracker. Now, the little Iowa history there. In 1987, the Chicago's renowned Joffrey Ballet premiered their version of the Nutcracker at the UI's Hancher Auditorium, the old auditorium. We now have a new one in Iowa City. Now, 30 years later, they have returned to do the same again, but with a new twist. Tell us what's going on at Hancher, the beautiful new Hancher Auditorium with the Nutcracker.
Well, Hancher co-commissioned this with the Joffrey Chicago, and this is going to be a preview performance. It's going to be this weekend. It's already started, and I've heard tickets are kind of scarce, but Brian Selznick updated the story, and Tony Award-winning Christopher Wheeldon put together this new choreography. It's set in the Chicago World's Fair of 1893. Still the same great music, although I do think they've revamped a couple of pieces, and they're going to have some of Orchestra Iowa musicians who are performing with them come up and play on stage. But it's going to be a phenomenal opportunity, and if you can get your hands on some tickets, try to get there, because this is going to be really cool. 30 area children, there's going to be at least 70 dancers on stage. Just a marvelous, marvelous performance.
Sounds wonderful. Jacqueline Hallblum, always wonderful to be with you. Well, let's go out with a little music from well-known Nutcracker, and we'll look forward to talking to you again. Again, Jacqueline Hallblum, Iowa Public Radio classical music host and host of IPR's monthly Iowa Arts Showcase. In this case, the showcase for both December and January. Thanks for the update, Jacqueline. Look forward to talking to you again in the new year.
Thanks, Ben.
That winds up this December 2nd edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. Get in touch with us through Iowa Public Radio's website. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.